Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today's show seems to have started at 2:30 instead of 2:45, something I found out about 5 minutes ago. So I've had to grab my guests, and in fact that was a surprise too. We now have two guests, not just one guest, on the show today. The first guest is Nikki Hamlin. Good afternoon, Nikki.
Hi, hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Nikki Hamlin is a filmmaker, and he currently has an exhibition called Zoetrope. Nikki Hamlin is Professor of Experimental Film and Senior Lecturer in Fine Art Media at the University for the Creative Arts, Canterbury, Kent, Lecturer in Visual Communication at the Royal College of Art, London. He's completed over 50 16mm films, video works and installations since 1974. He was also an active member of the London Filmmakers Cooperative and a co-founder and member of the editorial collective of Undercut Magazine, and is also the author of Film Art Phenomena, a survey of experimental film and video. So welcome back, Nikki. And you currently have this exhibition, Zoetrope, which is at the London Gallery West, which is at the Forum, University of Westminster, Watford Road, Harrow.
Maybe the first thing to say about it is it's not as far away as it sounds.
No, as I discovered when I did get there for the opening, and it is, yeah, surprisingly easy to get to, shall we say, on the Metropolitan line.
Yeah, it's a Northwick Park station and it's a short walk from there.
So. Yeah, and out of Northwick Park, basically you walk under the railway line and then you're actually on the campus, aren't you?
Yeah.
So it's, and then you,
it's about
you,
3 minutes walk.
Yeah, and it's a very, I was surprised actually. I must say, my own prejudice was that it would be some sort of Victorian red brick building, but in fact it's some very modern-looking glass smart gallery, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I think it's been built. It's been added on to the existing building fairly recently, and the feeling among the curators is that it's a bit over-designed. It's not ideal as a gallery space. But anyway, it seems to function fine for my show, and I'm very happy with the way it's all installed. And that's also thanks to the curator Carmen Billows, who had a lot to do with the way the work is arranged in the space.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Zoetrope. It's called Zoetrope, which is, of course, an old pre-cinema contraption, shall we call it, device for viewing moving images.
Yeah, it's one of those drums with a series of slits in it and a set of drawings inside. And when you rotate the drum, you, as the slit goes past your eye, the image is sort of flashed onto your eye, and you see a kind of movie, a little movie that repeats itself.
Yeah,
and one of the pieces in the show it looks a bit like a Zoetrope, and it's actually the show is named after that piece, and it's actually a plastic clothes peg basket which has got slotted sides.
Right.
So when it rotates, it generates these kind of moiré patterns.
Yeah.
So quite a lot of the pieces are exploring moiré patterns in one, found moiré patterns, not synthesized.
But the Zoetrope itself, what probably originates, what, from the mid 19th century or something?
Yeah.
And was part one of many sort of what might be called primitive cinema devices.
Like
is it similar to a praxinoscope, or is
an ophthalmoscope? There are two or three of them which have a drum. There's another one which, instead of having slits in the side, or slots rather, it has a mirrored. It has a series of mirrors in the center, and so you, rather than looking through a slit, you look onto the face of, you look onto into the center of the Zoetrope, or the
I think that's
a praxinoscope actually, and then you see that you still have a set of images around the inside of the drum, the circumference, but you see those reflected off the mirror rather than seeing them across the drum through a slit.
Yeah,
but it's the same idea really. What it does is presents, it's just a different way of presenting a series of still images in rapid succession, which is all that films are anyway.
Yeah, and does it? Do they also rely on the persistence of vision to work, as it were?
No, there's a big there's a lot of misunderstanding about persistence of vision. Which persistence of vision does exist, but it doesn't explain the illusion of movement. That's to do with, I can't remember if it's alpha or beta waves in the brain that you, whereby if you have two alternating spots on a surface, they flicker backwards and forwards, on off at a certain speed. They seem to be moving left to right rather than just appearing and disappearing, and that's not explained. That's not explained by the persistence of vision. It's another phenomenon. Right. There's a thing called critical flicker fusion as well, but that's slightly misleading. That's a number of frames per second you need to have to get the illusion of movement, and that's about 14, something like that, 14 frames. So 14 images per second is fast enough to give you... slower than that, you start to see a series of still images.
It starts to flicker.
Yeah, so it's called critical flicker threshold.
Right.
But there's not, that doesn't also entirely explain the psychological mechanism.
Right.
I should know about this better than I do, but it's not entirely straightforward. I mean, there are lots of there's still a lot of debate about how moving imagery is, or moving objects are processed in the visual cortex, because there are lots and lots of specialized cells which do different jobs. Some cells only react to left to right movement, some to up down.
Oh, really?
And the thing called the wagon wheel effect, for example, which people always thought was to do with film, to do with the way films in broke up movement and made it look as if wagon wheels were going backwards.
It looked like they're going backwards,
yeah.
So like in
but
Westerns,
you actually see that, you have that experience in real life, actually, in normal light. It's not peculiar to film.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at a lot of modern cars, perhaps not so much now, but there was a period when cars had spoked wheels, aluminium wheels or whatever.
Yeah.
And you could see that phenomenon. And it's to do with different some of these cells that react to left-right or right-left competing to process the data.
Right.
So for a while, the left-to-right movement one is firing, and then it gets tired and the other one takes over.
Right.
So things seem to start going backwards. So it's quite complicated.
It sounds very complicated.
And there are two competing theories. I think the one I've just described is the one that's winning at the moment. But there is another theory that it's to do with data being processed in packages rather than continuously. But
right.
I think that one's been discounted now.
It's interesting that it still hasn't been resolved after all this time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, neuroscience
is still up for grabs.
You would have thought that visual processing was pretty much sewn up. But I think there's still...
So the persistence of vision thing is a bit of a myth, then. That's not what it was.
It does exist. I mean, because obviously you stare at a bright light and you close your eye, you see, have an after image.
Yeah.
But that's not what explains the illusion of movement. It doesn't really seem to explain the continuity of movement, because if several frames of a movie just built up on your retina, you would see kind of blurred. You would see blurred imagery because, you know, there'd be one frame on your retina and then another one and another one, all in different positions.
Mm.
That would, you know, logically, that would give you a kind of blurry effect rather than a moving effect.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not an expert, though.
Oh, well, I don't know.
I'm not a psychologist.
That's good enough. No, well, it sounds like no one else has solved the problem either.
But it's interesting because in film theory, until very recently, it's been a persistent error that people have always referred to. Actually, embarrassingly, I refer to it in my book, actually, as well. I made the same mistake. I talked about persistence of vision.
Yeah.
But it really isn't to do with that.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. All right, so... So your exhibition, it harks back in some way to the roots of cinema?
Not really, no. It's just that I got interested in worry patterns and the way that camcorders process data, different kinds of camcorders process data in different ways.
Mm.
And so it's more about the kind of the interplay between fairly low quality camcorders that I've been using and these complex moving objects, like this peg basket, for example, or the double layer of mesh, plastic mesh on the back of a chair at a petrol station, stuff like that.
A lot of your films in this show are concentrating on this phenomenon.
Quite a few of them.
I suppose there's an interaction between what one refers to as moiré patterns in real life and the ability of the camera to capture that. Is that right?
Yeah, it's about that. It's about the way that it's about what the technology does to that.
So does the camera itself create a kind of moiré phenomenon?
Exactly.
So you're compounding this
exactly.
thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so each film is, can we just, I mean, have you got a, I've got a list here of the, they don't all, they're not all concerned with this, are they? It's mostly
no,
the
no.
short films or
yeah,
not.
There are a series of, there are five pieces on monitors which are all more or less, or not, actually no, they're not all to do with Mario patterns, but they're to do with related kind of phenomena. And then there are some longer pieces which are made in a very different way, which is to do with taking shot footage of movements and then breaking them down into three frame segments which are then looped. So you have a three frame loop going for 10 seconds, and then it shifts on one frame, and that generates a lot of, if you kind of fixate on part of the screen, it generates all sorts of strange optical effects.
Right.
So that some of the work is kind of exploring that. And those, there are a couple of pieces which are made that way, which are longer, which are edited, intensively edited in that way, using that system. And then there are a couple of films which are not so much to do with that, which are in a separate room, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, quite a lot of the work is, and then there's a, quite a lot of the work is to do with what you've been talking about. And then there's a film loop as well.
And is it, it sounds from what you've just said that the, that this seems to be, it's concerned with lo-fi equipment or something?
Yeah.
Does it not happen with higher grade equipment?
There is a piece in the show which is was shot on a much better camera. But it's got lots of net curtains in it, so that so the camera's still struggling a bit. And it, as you say, it adds a kind of layer, compounds the textures in a way.
Right.
So even using a,
so it's like the camera can't quite grasp what it's focused on. It can't see the, and so it creates its own. I don't know.
It's compressing. It's using
compression or something.
Yeah. In a way, it's to do with the way data is compressed and recorded. Because unless you use very, very expensive cameras, very, very high-end cameras, well, even then, arguably, there'll be a certain point at which you'll still get the same things will still start to happen.
Right.
It's just that they happen at quite a coarse level with, if you use a cheap camera,
yeah.
as I did for some of the pieces. But some of them were made on, there are a couple which were made on more expensive cameras, and then there's a couple which are more on kind of an intermediate, on a 5.4 Panasonic, you know, middle range kind of thing, which I use for some of them.
And does the actual content of the image have any significance?
No, they're just purely, they're representations, but that's all. Yeah, they're just objects in the world, really. Yeah, fences.
So it's a yellow laundry basket, which could be anywhere.
Yeah.
And but some of the things are shot in Windsor, Ontario, aren't they?
There's one piece which was made there, which is a children's playground. But actually, the equipment that's in the playground is the same kind of equipment you see in playgrounds all over the place, really.
Right.
It's a perforated steel drum that you can crawl through, so a child can crawl through it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's raised off the ground a bit. So one of the pieces, I shot footage of that and then did this looping process with it. Another one is a film of a fence filmed from a train at East Croydon station. You on a sunny day at a certain time of day, the fence, the vertical bars of the fence cast vertical shadows on these porter cabins which are behind them, and that when the train moves, that generates a kind of moiré effect as well,
right,
which I then film and then looped again using these three frame loops. Some of them were, there were some pieces which were shot on a beach in the Camargue, three of them actually. One of them's inspired by, it's called Spinning Shadow. It's inspired by this book by James Elkins called Seeing Dark Things. Not James Elkins, I beg your pardon, Roy Sorensen.
Right.
Seeing Dark Things, which is about shadows and holes.
Right.
And he's a philosopher, but he does these thought experiments. You know, he asks these questions like, does a moving object cast a moving shadow? And then he tries to persuade you that it does.
Right.
And so one of the pieces was kind of directly inspired by that, which was it's a wicker basket on a stick spinning, and the stick was stuck into the sand, and then the basket spins round, and the sun shines through the basket and casts a shadow of the spinning basket onto the sand.
Right.
Some of them are, that one is a bit more contrived, but most of them are just observational pieces, really.
Right. And there's also film work.
There's a 60 millimeter loop which is site-specific. It's projected very near the smoker's corner where people go outside the building to smoke.
Yeah.
And it's of a cigarette burning down in negative, black and white negative. And it's shot at 4 frames a second, so it's much slower. The speed is slowed down by, or speeded up rather, by a factor of 6.
Right.
So it's a cigarette, a very extreme close-up of a cigarette burning down. So the beginning of the shot, you see the whole cigarette, and at the end, it's just the ash.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of transformation from.
And I think you've got various prints of that one, I think.
Well, I made it several times. I made 5.
Mm.
Yeah. Because it's not a print, it's actually the original. It's the original film.
So in each case, they're each unique.
Yeah, they're unique. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Each
right.
one is slightly different. And I made them all with Benson and Hedges cigarettes. Am I allowed to say that?
No, too
and
late.
Then somebody said, "Oh, Marlboro are better because they got more saltpeter and they burn better." So I bought some Marlboro,
yeah.
And it wasn't true.
Okay.
Actually, the Benson and Hedges burn perfectly on their own.
Right.
Whereas the Marlboros went out.
Yeah.
So I had to stop using them.
Okay. Not French cigarettes then.
I didn't try those, but maybe Gitane or something would
Gitane
be good.
Gitane or, yeah.
They would be, yeah, that's yeah. worth it. I mean, actually, there's a project in that.
Do you smoke, Laura?
She's just given up.
Okay,
now we can briefly introduce our other guest, Laura...
Morshkin.
Morshkin.
Morshkin. How do we spell
Morshkin.
That? Morshkin.
Morshkin. It's M-O-R-S-C-H.
Yeah.
M-O-R-C-H. S-C-H. Morsh.
Hyphen.
Keen
is K-A-H-N. K-I-H-N, sorry.
K-I-H-N. Mm. Morsh Kine. Keen. Oh, interesting name.
Yeah, it's from Eastern France.
Eastern France.
Yeah.
Really? Sounds almost Russian. No? Okay, no Russian connection
no.
at all.
Is it a sort of Alsace name or... Alsace?
Alsace is north,
no,
isn't
Lorraine.
It?
Lorraine.
Alsace,
yeah.
Lorraine. Oh, right, okay.
Oh, yeah, so it's kind of German.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
Of,
yeah.
It's kind of German.
So on the subject of cigarettes, my brother used to smoke about 40 Gitane a day, the very strongest
yeah.
ones, and he gave up once they stopped producing the strong ones. Because they're not what they were, apparently. And now he's not interested anymore. But what did you smoke?
I smoke tobacco. Roll tobacco.
Oh, roll tobacco.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But I stop, huh?
You stop that. Good, okay.
But so, I think of cigarettes all the day. It's horrible.
So this is a non-advert for cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah.
We are... Wavelength is opposed to cigarettes. We are... Okay, but so Laura is here ostensibly as an ambassador for her fanzine.
Oh yeah, well I'm going to plug it now.
Okay, let's.
It's called Le Nouvel Esprit de Vandalisme, and it's
the new spirit of vandalism.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's currently issue number 5, which is a special issue on Latin American punk and Chicano punk.
Right.
And the whole issue is themed around that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Around Tex-Mex punk.
Tex-Mex punk.
In France? In Paris? Or?
No, in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles? Mm. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. So you produce this fanzine and you're a curator of sorts. Is that true?
Yeah, I curate the fanzine.
Okay.
So I invite artists and theoricians, philosophers.
Uh-huh.
And to contribute to the fanzine.
Yeah.
So this one, it's about the teen fantasy in America Latina. So we speak about punk.
Right.
Punk music, but there is also poetry and cooking.
And it's still published? You produce a hard copy magazine, as it were?
Yeah, it's a photocopy.
Right.
Yeah, it's really in the spirit of fanzine. So it's cheap and made by hand.
But does it also exist online or only as a magazine?
No, only as a magazine.
Only as a magazine.
But you can see some sample on the website.
Right.
But you have to...
Which is what? We better give that a... where's the website?
LeNouvelEspritDuVandalisme.com.
Right. So everything is called Le Nouvel Esprit du Vandalisme.
Yeah, the website and the fanzine.
So this sounds—is this sort of anarchic or in the vandalism part? Is that willful destruction of?
Yes.
Everything
somewhere. No, because the idea is to start with graffiti.
Gravity.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for each issue, invite a graffiti artist to make the cover.
Oh, graffiti. Sorry, I thought I was thinking graffiti. Gravity. I don't
graffiti.
Know why. I
must graffiti. Sorry for my
yeah,
accent.
Yeah. No, that's all right. A graffiti artist.
Yeah.
I see.
And in France and maybe as in England too, graffiti, it's a kind of vandalism.
Right.
So I try to think in this concept of vandalism, but in to give to the concept more sense,
mm-hmm.
that is not only a way to think that it's a free destruction, but it's a destruction of some things which gets a means.
Productive, sort of, in a way.
Yeah.
Right. Productive.
Productive destruction.
Destruction.
Yeah.
Mm. There was a very good show at the Cartier Foundation of maybe 2 years ago.
Of graffiti
yeah, artists.
Yeah. 3 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was amazed. There was a very impressive one where these guys had, they almost had like a hose. they had like a pickup truck, you know, and they had this whole contraption on the back. and they would sort of drive up and pull up somewhere and then use this thing, like sort of just this enormous jet with his hose, which made this sort of like 50-foot kind of pattern. Uh-huh. And I was always tempted. I always thought, if I was going to get into graffiti, I think that was, I'd love to do that. It would be quite liberating. You could do serious damage to public buildings with such a device,
yeah.
I think. But anyway, so back to Zoetrope. Nikki, perhaps briefly. Okay. Do you want to? Should we play one of these? You've got a couple of sound pieces from Zoetrope.
Yeah, a lot of the work is silent, but there are three. Well, there are two pieces which are, two pieces that I made on the beach have just kind of a beachy soundtrack, but there are two other pieces which are more conceived as having the sound being important. And one of them, the first one, is called Clapping, and I filmed myself clapping my hands together, and then I edited it so that there was, each clap was just one frame. So it's a bit like a sync mark, you know, when you, you know, if you haven't got a clapperboard, you can just clap your hands and film that. And so there are 25 claps per second, and it's a 1 minute piece, so that's 1500. Claps in
and
a minute.
You see, you clap. It's not a loop. Then you're actually clapping.
Well, it runs as a loop. It runs as a continuous piece, but it's a minute long, and then it just starts again.
But to record the 1 minute, did you clap continuously?
Yeah, I did 1500 claps.
Wow. Okay.
Which took a little while. It didn't take that long. I mean, a few minutes, 6 minutes maybe. I can't remember now.
Right.
No, it must have taken longer than that. Yeah, I was just sort of clapping like that, you know, not too fast. And then when I edited it, I cut out all the frames which didn't have the clap sound on them. So you just, the remaining frames are the ones with the sound of the hands clapping.
Right.
So that means that there are, in a 1 minute piece, there are 1500 frames, and every single frame has the clapping sound on it. So this is the soundtrack.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yes, very nice. Yeah.
And children really like it. I showed it once before at it was in an exhibition, in a show at the Royal College of Art done by research students, and children really seem to like it.
I'll bet.
And they try
do.
To clap along.
So what's the image with it?
It's just the hands clapping.
So it's his sync sound.
Yeah, it's sync sound.
Synchronized sound of the.
But it's you know, when you look at it, the sink seems to sort of break down. I mean, it's sink is a funny thing. It's I mean,
really?
Mike Dunford, the filmmaker, made a film, a really good film called Sink Sound, I think, where he just filmed a mouth talking close up, and after a while, everything starts to go in your perception. Things seem to go out of sync and strange things seem to happen. And I suppose because sync is a kind of function of film, it's something that's peculiar to film. Because most of the time you're walking around, you're hearing sounds and you're not seeing the source of the sound necessarily. And even when you are seeing the source, there's still something rather mysterious about the way sounds come out of somebody's mouth.
Right.
Because the sound isn't being generated, it's being generated somewhere in your throat, you know, and you... I mean, there's something rather intangible or something that can't be pinned down about sync. And I think you film in a way emphasizes that. And a lot of the struggle with film is to try and keep everything apparently synchronized, you know. And when I worked at the BBC, and this is probably influenced the piece, that there were these people who were obsessed with how to synchronize film and the picture and the soundtrack, because with film editing, you know, they're on separate strips of film,
yeah,
and there'd be these really pedantic conversations about where the on a single frame, whereabouts on that frame did the bang occur?
Right.
Was it nearly on the next frame, or nearly on the previous frame, or in the middle, or somewhere else? You know, they have these conversations about that, and then they say, well, you know, if the bang is near the nearly on the next frame, then you should make the sound slightly late or something, you know, because naturally sound travels slower than light. So, and they'd have these incredible conversations about this, and it was, in a way, it was just ridiculous, but it was also quite fascinating. So I mean, that's something I'm...
Are you aware of the delay on digital and FM radio? Have you noticed?
Yeah,
you
have noticed that. Yeah, because I sometimes have occasionally... It's about 4 seconds, isn't it? Or
it's
six
very
seconds.
Strange, because if you listen to the news on digital radio, I mean, basically every time they make this announcement, you miss... I'm staggered that they haven't been able to remedy it, because it'll say something, you know, they're supposed to say it's March the 15th at 9 o'clock, and you get like 15th at 9 o'clock, and it's like, you know, they've missed the whole bit. But it's sort of...
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it from the time point of view.
Anyway... Okay, so anything more about these films that are showing in the Zoetrope?
Well, I've got a second piece which has got a soundtrack, which is we could listen to a little bit of. It's a much longer piece. It's 14 minutes, but
we could listen to some of it.
Yeah, we could listen to a minute of it or something.
So this is called Now Wash Your Hands.
Yeah.
I think I see this at the Royal College?
Yeah, you might have done, yes. Where
this is a shot of a sink with a tap and running water.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
I guess a similar process. I filmed myself just rinsing my hands under a tap and then cut it down to... took each frame and stretched it so that each frame lasts for, I think it's 10 seconds. But what happens is it's... because it has to be shown on a cathode ray tube monitor, an old-fashioned TV, on a flat screen, in interlaced mode, not progressive scan, which is what most modern video is done in.
Right.
And that way, what happens is the image jitters between two fields, because there are in interlaced video image, the image is made up of the frame. One frame is made up of two interlaced fields, and each field has half the information for the frame in it, and So when you play it, you hear, you see a sort of, the image has this sort of blurry rhythm, kind of blurred, jumpy quality to it, backwards and forwards, and the sound does the same thing. So what you're hearing is the sound of running water, actually, but you're just hearing a hundredth of a second alternating with the next hundredth of a second, backwards and forwards for 10 seconds, and then it moves on one frame to the next pair. So that's how that one works.
Right, So it has to be on an old cathode ray monitor.
Yeah, it has
monitor
to be on an old... exactly. Otherwise
to work.
Yeah,
otherwise it doesn't... Yeah. It could never be shown on TV, for example.
No, it couldn't.
Wouldn't work.
Not anymore, no.
Right. Is this a willful sort of desire to be outside of the loop, as it
were? No, I think I could make a version which would work on a flat screen on a modern TV, but... When I made it, that was current technology and still.
Yeah,
it wasn't particularly a willful thing, but it does point up the issue of medium specificity and
right.
that whole thing about whether you show, say, video work made in the 70s on equipment from the 70s. And
there,
I mean, actually, a lot of people think that should be the case. And there was a big show in Germany at the Hamburger Bahnhof in Berlin, where they showed a lot of work, early video work, using period equipment, you know, like these incredible video projectors. I can't remember. Peter Campus, is it? Yeah, they showed his work on a video projector from the 1970s. And
the whole
show was shown on right. And there's also that group called the who do the John Cage, what are they called? The Langham Research Center.
Oh, yes, yes.
They use period tape recorders, and they did cartridge music using 1950s turntables and stuff like that, 1950s arms and
right.
cartridges.
Yeah. I remember you telling me about this, where they make the sound just using the cartridge of the...
And doing things to it, or replacing the stylus with a spring or something like that,
right.
or bits of metal, you know, or whatever.
Right.
And then they kind of dress up like John Cage, you know, they wear these sort of white shirts, and it's a bit silly, really.
Right.
But they're very good. I mean, it's a very good... they do it very well.
Yeah.
And there's an album, they've done a vinyl LP of that as well.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right, right. All right, so should we play a bit of this then? So this is... actually, the video lasts for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... But we won't... Obviously, we probably won't play that much.
No.
I'll leave it to you to to decide.
Yeah, all right.
Well, there we are. We could talk over the top of it for a while, because it runs on, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does.
20 minutes.
Yeah.
Is there any variation in this?
Yeah, it shifts. I mean, the quality of the sound shifts.
Oh, yeah, because, so I can hear it then. Yeah.
I mean, what I like about it is it's very paradoxical, because water, it doesn't sound watery. It sounds very dry. It sounds like some sort of insect
that's
or something.
True, yes.
But it's actually, all it is very, very short fragments of the sound of running water.
Right. Which you've chopped up? Or?
Yeah, so that you're just hearing the sound from one field alternating with the adjacent field. So that's like one frame of time, one frame of image.
Yeah.
But with interlaced video, it's the way the interlaced image is presented is alternate fields.
Right.
So one field has half the information, has all the even numbered lines of video image in, and the other one has all the odd numbered lines, and it's just jittering backwards and forwards between them 50 times a second.
Do you think that? I mean, when people are viewing this, is it necessary for them to know what is going on? Can you appreciate it without understanding the technical?
Oh yeah, it's fairly self evident what's going on. I mean, it's self explanatory. I think you're seeing, because you can see gradually progression. You know, you can see the image moves forward a little bit every 10 seconds.
Oh okay, right, right. You'd certainly never know it was water unless one had been told.
No.
Anything in the title, Now Wash Your Hands, is there any kind of significance in this?
Because I filmed it in one of the toilets at the Royal College of Art.
Right.
And, you know, there are always those signs on the door which say, now wash your hands.
Yeah.
That's all really.
Right.
But it's the last piece in the show. So when you walk through the show, the first one is clapping. It's like a sort of welcome to it.
Right.
And then the last, this is the last piece. So as you go out, yeah. you see the thing now, wash your hands.
So right.
Just it's a bit silly, really, but okay. No, it's quite a nice idea.
Yeah. And there's at least, this is a 20-minute film, and yeah. there was a room at the back with a sort of dark,
yeah.
where it was more like a dark auditorium.
Yeah.
I can't remember what was showing in there. What was
Object
that?
Studies and Pro Agri, which are two 16mm films which have
oh,
been
right.
transferred
right.
to digital files.
And these are all recent films. They're all sort of date from what, 2000? The earliest
the
one is
years.
2006 or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, sort of, Object Studies is 2006, I think.
Okay.
That's
well, just to
thing.
Just to sort of recap then, that this today's guest is Nicky Hamlin, and his exhibition Zoetrope runs at the Nicky. Help me out. Where is it?
It's at the London Gallery West in the Forum at University of Westminster in Northwick Park.
Right.
Which is the University of Westminster Harrow campus.
Yeah.
And it's on until the 3rd of May.
Right.
And there's a talk. With the curator Carmen Billows on at 1 p.m. on the 28th of April, which is I think it's a Wednesday,
right? Yeah. And so, presumably, for more details, people could go to what are they?
If,
you know,
if they go to the London Gallery West website,
yeah,
I think that's what you do.
Or Zoetrope. In fact,
yeah,
on the Resonance website, it's got Zoetrope with a link to the exhibition.
Right. Okay.
So, if you go to the Resonance website and look at the news. Page, as it were, mm. and click on Zoetrope. It'll take you to details of the exhibition, which runs until the 3rd of May.
Mm.
All right. And you've brought something. Should we fade out now? Wash your hands
yeah.
now, I think. Kind of. yeah. And you've brought. We have another.
Oh, another thing. Thing to plug.
No? Well, yes, there is that, but
yeah.
you sound like you're hesitant. You have something else we're going to... Are we going to move to that?
Yeah, maybe we could move to that and then go on to the other stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's another guest who isn't here.
Yeah, that's... I'm just going to give you the DVD.
The CD.
Which
right.
is a CD by Mika Vigno, which was made to accompany a book of photographs by Josephine Michel called Halfway to White. And it's published by Touch, which is a music label. They do people like Chris yeah. Watson and Philip Jeck and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's run by John Wozencroft, who's a colleague of mine at the Royal College of Art, and Mike Harding. And mm-hmm. This is the first book publication that they've done. So it's a book of photographs, and the photographs were then sent to Mika Vigno, and he made a CD, five tracks to go in response to the photographs.
All right.
And that's it really.
So it's a sort of grey linen backed book,
yeah,
which I haven't
produced.
Seen before. I know nothing
yeah.
about this whatsoever,
right.
but it's
okay.
the first time I've seen it.
Well,
it called again?
It's called Halfway to White.
Right.
And the photographs, a lot of them are taken in Paris, which is where Josephine is from.
Mm.
And they are, most of them, a lot of them are photographs of objects or close-ups of, for example, of a scooter or scaffolding, or quite a lot of building site type images, lots of very textural things. And then there, when the photographs are taken, she kind of calculatedly overexposes them, so in such a way as to kind of reconfigure the elements in the image.
Right.
So the relationship between elements becomes ambiguous sort of unclear, or some things come together and mm-hmm. on the same plane, which would be on separate planes if all the information were there.
Right.
So actually, in a way, it's sort of connected to some of the films in my exhibition. I hadn't thought of this before, but you know, in a way, some of those video pieces that I made also operate on a similar principle of sort of withholding information, or not so much withholding it, but reducing the information that's in the image, and that generates those things that you were talking about earlier. You know, the another layer of something.
Mm.
It's a different process, but
so it's a collaboration between the sound artist and the photographer.
Yeah,
and the result is this book, Halfway to White.
Yeah,
and it comes with a CD.
Yeah,
Which we could play a bit of
yeah.
now. Any particular track?
Well, maybe a bit of track three.
Track three. Okay. Okay, so that was what's the name?
It's got
of
a title.
The...
Actually, yeah. That track has a title. Hang on, I'm just going to look it up. It's called Notes on the Exposures. So there are five tracks, and they're all 10 or 11 minutes each.
Right.
Nearer 11, actually.
Uh-huh. What's the name of the artist again?
Josephine Michelle.
And?
Mika Vainio.
Okay.
He's quite a famous... he had that band called Pansonic before.
Right.
He's a Finnish electronic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are they both based in Paris?
No, I think he lives in Berlin.
Right.
The other thing and Josephine lives in London.
Hmm. And Laura, are you now living in London?
No, I'm here for 2 months.
2 months in London.
Yeah.
Okay. So are you curating something here? Or?
No, I'm coming just for see the edition scene. Photographic edition
okay.
scene.
Okay. Right.
And make a fanzine here.
And make a fanzine here?
Yeah.
Here in London?
Yeah.
Okay. Any plans? Anything focused on anything particular? Or?
For the moment, I do my research.
Uh-huh.
But I'm quite fascinating about the truck ice cream.
Oh, you know ice cream vans?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh,
she was thinking about hiring an ice cream van and selling artist books from it. which is
okay.
And then you had an idea about Parkview, didn't you? Parkview Cafe. Because we keep seeing cafes called Parkview Cafe.
Oh, right.
So that might be a theme. That's a potential theme for a...
Parkview Cafes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
for it, that would be issue 6, wouldn't it? Of the
Yeah.
Because there are 5 issues so far.
Yeah.
And I have something in one of the... Is it number 3?
Number 3, yeah. With Josephine Michel.
Yeah. Just a short essay to go with one of the photographs, which is also in the book, actually.
Right.
And then I was supposed to mention that it's not out yet. It's out in May, but you can pre-order it on Touch website.
Yeah.
And there's also an interview with her with Roy Exley, which is on the Photographers Gallery blog.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
there's an essay by Justin Coombs on Photo Monitor website.
I just remembered you mentioned Mike Dunford earlier.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm pretty sure he's at the NFT tonight.
Oh, really?
Well, there's a season, isn't there, starting up?
Oh,
called Radical Films of the 1970s.
Yeah.
And I think I'm pretty sure that tonight's programme includes an introductory talk with Mike Dunford and some other people.
Oh, right.
I'm not sure what the programme is. It includes one of his films, which might even be the one you mentioned.
Sound, which is a really, really good film, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I brought... Moving swiftly on.
Yes, yes.
No, I brought a couple of things. Because those two soundtracks from my films had very insistent rhythms, I brought a couple of pieces along which to make a little mini theme out of that. And one of them is a piece by Alvin Lucier called... what's it called?
Here we are. Here's the cover.
Something sidecar for the orchestra.
Silver Street Car for the orchestra.
And it's for solo triangle.
Right.
And it's a kind of instruction piece. So the performer just gets... They're given 5 parameters, just a set of instructions, like how loud... They can vary these 5 parameters, like the loudness, the frequency of the beating, where you beat the triangle, how much damping you use, like how much you hold it tight with your hand so that stop it ringing, and where you damp. I think those are the 5 parameters. So the performer just plays the triangle, and I suppose it's the idea that normally triangle players are very under-occupied
Indeed.
In the orchestra.
Yes.
And this time it's the other way around.
I was going to say, is this the only known piece for triangle?
I don't know. It's the only one that I know about, actually.
Yeah,
and it's a really beautiful piece.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's on a mini one of those mini CDs.
In the orchestra, it's normally like the person on the well, not, what's the other one? Not the kettle drums or something.
Yeah,
it's sort of poised, sort of waiting.
Yes,
for an hour and a
40
half.
40 bars. Yeah.
The sort of responsibility must be enormous to get it right, to come in at exactly the right moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So should we play a snatch of that?
Yeah.
So this is Alvin Lucier, Silver Streetcar for the Orchestra, and it's Rainer Römer, I think, if that's the correct pronunciation, on the triangle. So I'll just fade out your first one. ¶¶ Have you listened to this piece all the way through? How long is it going for?
It's about 15 minutes. Yeah, I have, actually. It's totally mesmerising, and it's totally fascinating, because you...
Actually, it says there's still 17 minutes left
on it. Oh, okay, it's longer than that.
So it must be about 20 minutes,
yeah.
And is there much variation?
Yeah, but it's quite subtle, because it's just gradual. So, you know, the damping will get gradually more and more, and then it will release a bit, and then at the same time the volume or the frequency... The frequency of the beating is pretty regular all the way through the whole piece.
Right.
But yeah, I really like it, actually. He's a very interesting composer. He's done a lot of interesting work. Mm. I mean, the famous piece is I'm Sitting in a Room, which is that piece where he plays his voice back and...
Oh, yes. I know the one, A Long Thin Wire.
Yeah, that's also really... A lot of it uses kind of equipment to set up drone-y, or not drones, but to set up vibrations, which then he has feedback systems, and he's interested in feedback.
So that was you've also brought in a vinyl LP by Bruce McClure.
Yeah, this is from
some sort of connection between these two pieces.
There's a connection. He did a show in London last week, about 10 days ago, and he works with modified 16mm film projectors and short loops, which are just black and white frames, which he makes by bleaching 16mm film, and then he plays the sound from those that those loops generate are played through guitar effects pedals, and he's been doing that for quite a few years. And last year at Media City Film Festival, which was their 20th anniversary edition, Bruce and Alvin Lussier did a concert together at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit, which is across the river from Windsor, Ontario. So it's they always have an event there on the first day of the festival, and it's a really fantastic festival. And I think they're struggling a bit this year. They're having a Kickstarter campaign to try raise money.
Right.
But that was the connection. But also the fact that both these pieces are very kind of insistently rhythmic.
Hmm.
So Bruce's soundtracks are very rhythmic, and the Alvin Lussier piece is obviously very rhythmic too.
So this is this looks like a very limited edition sort of vinyl LP signed by Bruce McClure.
Yeah.
Vouchsafe Me More Sound Picture.
Yeah.
And then Fane Make Glories in brackets. And then underneath it says Oldie English Spelling Bee, number 36. Looks like a sort of hand...
Yeah, it's a hand-printed
cover, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's really, because his work up until not so much the show he did at Apiary Studios last week, but the sound has become more and more dominant in his work, and the image less and less. So the last show I saw before this one, before the last one, Apiary Studios, the image was very small and dim on the screen, but the sound was extremely loud. I mean, there were earplugs available.
All right.
And he ploughs a very narrow furrow. Every piece is slightly different, and he's experimented with different kinds of projector gate, homemade modifications to the gate. The projectors are modified so that the bulbs can be dimmed or brought up. So it's still using film, but film is more like a sort of starting point, really. It's more about the projection.
Right.
So this album, I think, is from 2009, and it was recorded... I can't remember where, actually. Walker Arts Centre in Minneapolis, I think.
I'll look at the cover. Yes. 2009. Well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com at the new time of 2:30 to 3:30. Repeats at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, but as far as I know, it will always be 2:30 to 3:30 now. I hope you didn't miss the first 15 minutes. Today's guests were Nikki Hamlin and Laura Morshkin. Laura Morshkin is the curator and editor of a fanzine, which is presently up to number 5, and number 6 will be perhaps something to do with London ice cream vans and Parkview cafes. Nikki's exhibition, Zoetrope, runs at the London Gallery West in Harrow.
Northwick Park.
Yeah, Northwick Park, Zoetrope. That runs from 9 until 5. Until
open every day.
Every day, including
every
Sundays.
Day, including Sundays,
oh,
yeah.
Right. Mm. Video installations and film loops and so on. Yeah. And that runs until the 5th of May. 3rd of May. And, you wanted to play one track to play out with.
Yeah.
This is Bruce McClure at the moment.
Yeah.
But you had something else.
So that was... I just brought... because of this, I had this thought about rhythmic things and something nice to play out with. I brought this Derek Bailey album, Guitar, Drums and Bass, which was a... He did lots of great collaborations with people, and I think he really sort of pushed his practice, if you like, by collaborating with all kinds of people, including tap dancers and just anybody who would work with him, but keeping a very sort of high critical standard as well, and just wonderfully kind of experimental. And he heard this drum and bass guy from Birmingham on the radio and thought, oh, it'd be fun to make an album with this guy. So the drum and bass guy, DJ Ninj, sent Derek Bailey these tracks, and then he plays along to the drum and bass tracks. And I just think it's fantastic. Again, it's very rhythmic, and it's a clash, a sort of culture clash, because it's drum and bass, and then it's free improvised guitar coming together in the most unlikely combination. But it's a great album, actually.
So this is Derek Bailey, and what's the album called?
It's called Guitar, Drums and Bass, and it's from, I'm just trying to remember the year it came out, actually. It's been out for a while. 96, I think.